my good horse. Homo economicus is a sociopath. Homo economicus is what happens if people behave the way economists predict that they will behave. And these scholars who love capitalism said, if you do that, you will create a nation of sociopaths.
In the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony.
You're listening to episode 619 of Unwelcome Guests, The Financialization of Nature and the Nature of Financialization. I'm Robin Upton, and you've just heard a familiar sentiment, albeit, as Bill Black, financial regulator, points out, one that's rather unexpected in a book designed to champion capitalism. Is it just an oversight on the part of the authors, or are they perhaps so inured to behaving as proper economists and rational actors that sociopathic self-interest seems like second nature to them? We're going to hear more from Bill Black, ex-financial regulator and expert on financial control fraud, in our second hour. Well, last week's episode on the police state, I suppose you could say, it's a legal control fraud. What happens when the criminals get control of the legal system? Not a lot of criminals get put in jail, so top legal officials, bankers, presidents can throw out things like constitutions or other well-established statutes and not get brought to book. Now, the bailout and the financial fraud, yes, certainly criminal, immoral, but in another sense is still virtual. People getting kicked out of their homes is the real world, and like the true sociopathic actors they are in the economic models of economists, large banks and other corporations make increasingly free with the resources of the state, since why wouldn't they? To kick people out of their homes, fake foreclosure documents, or do other tasks which increase their profits. Whilst this is an all too real harsh reality for people in the US, how much harsher is it for people in the developed world, who often have minimal understanding of the process, minimal acceptance of the process? And what they do know is those people turfing them off their land have superior weaponry. This is a situation that millions of people are now facing due to the financialization of nature. The idea that this imaginary concept of money, interest, debt, these constructions should take precedence over traditional ideas about how the world should be organized. So no, trying to make sure everybody gets fed may be less important, according to certain diseased minds, than ones and zeros inside of computers. We're going to be hearing nearly an hour's interview with Joan Baxter. This is C.S. Soong interviewing her for Against the Grain. As usual, the full interview is available for download from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/619.
My name is C.S. Soong. Many nations in Africa are sorely lacking in arable land, so you would think their governments would want to safeguard that land for the growing of crops for domestic consumption. But that is not the case in too many locations. According to a new set of reports released by the Oakland Institute, many African governments are actually encouraging a frenzied land grab conducted not by Africans but by foreign investors. Land is being leased at an accelerating rate to profit-hungry entities who plan to grow not crops for the domestic market, but, for example, biofuels for export. But this is only the beginning of the story, a story that prominently features the World Bank and its determination to keep Africa, quote, open for business, the momentous corporatization of agriculture and its consequences for farmers and the environment, the use of all kinds of deception to persuade landowners to sign away their holdings, and spirited protests against the land deals by local communities and activists. Joan Baxter is a journalist and researcher who's lived and worked in Africa for three decades. She is the author of two new reports entitled Understanding Land Investment Deals in Africa, about what's happening in the nations of Mali and Sierra Leone. The reports, produced by the Oakland Institute, are part of a seven-country case study project that examines the impact and implications of land acquisitions in Africa. When I spoke with Joan Baxter, I asked her about the magnitude of land grabbing around the globe.
Well, that's one of the problems, is that it's been happening so quickly and with so little transparency that there aren't any firm figures. But the World Bank itself, being called to task on this a couple of years ago, estimated that in the year 2009 alone, close to 60 million hectares of agricultural land were taken long-term lease or purchased in 1 year. And that's an area about the size of France.
And you write that this trend of land grabbing gained traction after the global food and fuel crisis of 2008. So the rate of large-scale land acquisitions has increased in the last several years?
Exponentially. And it's not just the fuel and food crisis, it's also the financial crisis. There are an awful lot of super wealthy people out there looking for a new, safe place to grow their money. Some investors have said that farmland is like gold, only better. So farmland has become like the new gold. So it was spurred by certainly the climate change and then people moving to biofuels, which means they need land to produce them. And they're looking at long-term fuel prices and peak oil and so on. So they're looking for places to grow massive amounts of biofuels. And then, as I said, the financial crisis. People are looking for a really profitable place to put their capital. And I'm not talking about the average citizen. I'm talking about the wealthy corporations, fund managers, pension fund managers, banks, and so on.
Which suggests that speculation plays a large role in these patterns of land acquisition.
Indeed, some of the cases that I looked at in Mali and in Sierra Leone, some of them definitely are going into production for biofuels. For example, in Sierra Leone, all of the large land leases to date seem to have been taken out for biofuels, for oil palm or sugar cane that can be made into biofuels for export to Europe. The same is true also in Mali, but there's also some food mixed in. But in general, it's speculation. There are many leases that have been taken out where nothing has been done. Some of the contracts are so fuzzy and so secret that we don't even know if there are any clauses in them that would say, for example, if somebody has taken out a lease of 100,000 hectares, if they have a certain number of years before they have to actually start using that land, or if they're just literally hedging and speculating on that farmland.
Are only private entities and investors acquiring land around the globe, or are public entities doing so as well?
It just seems like everybody's involved. There are, for example, in Sierra Leone, it's largely European corporations, although now there's an Indian corporation that's moved in. Companies that have been involved in mining or oil till now, or even other forms of manufacturing, have set up subsidiaries that have gone into so-called agricultural investment. In Mali, for example, there's sovereign wealth funds, certainly Muammar Gaddafi's. Malibya is a corporation that belongs to the Libyan state, has 100,000 hectares, plus an additional 40,000 hectares, which also somehow belongs to Libya because it's supposed to be a conglomeration of West African states. Also, the Saudis are very much involved, and in their case, they're interested in food production. So very, very large and wealthy Saudi individuals or corporations or sovereign wealth funds from the Middle Eastern countries that have a problem with food production and water are also very much involved in this. And behind it all is financing that's often coming from hedge funds. The Oakland Institute found out that several major university pension funds are being invested through the hedge funds into this farmland investment. So it's more or less a free-for-all. Anybody who's got capital and wants to put it somewhere where they think it's going to get a huge return on their investment is looking at this farmland.
How attractive has Africa in particular become to foreign investors looking to acquire land?
Extremely. 70%, even according to the World Bank report, 70% of those long-term leases or purchases that they were able to document just in 2009, and of course it's escalated since then, were in Africa. And there are reasons for that. Partly, there's another issue here. It's not just land grabbing, it's also water grabbing. Water is becoming more and more scarce, more and more precious. Climate change is affecting many countries in the Middle East and in Asia. And so they're looking not just for land, but also for water. So many people have dubbed it also a water grab. So Africa is very, very attractive in that sense, because there are countries that still have major rivers and so on that have, where they can get water essentially for free. In addition, land throughout Africa in general, and this is a big sweeping generalization because there are variations, but land still tends to be communally owned. That means that traditional leaders, maybe the custodians of the land, who are supposed to be looking after it for generations to come, and then land-owning families have the right to use the land, and they have the right to lease out the land if they want to, but it's still very much viewed as a communal resource. So that makes them extremely vulnerable. They've been told for many, many years that their smallholder form of farming is backwards or primitive and non-productive. They've been convinced of that, although there's never been any proof. In fact, there's been evidence to the contrary, that their agroecological farming methods are the most sustainable. And over the years, also through the structural adjustment programs that the World Bank and IMF imposed on Africa, there was ever-reducing amounts of investment and help for those smallholder farmers. In most countries, the majority of the population are still smallholder farmers, family farmers that work on that communal land or on the land that their family has used for generations. And if an investor comes in and makes a lot of sweeping promises that they're going to bring development, and the traditional leaders get involved and the governments get involved and think this is a wonderful way to modernize their country, then they are the ones who are losing their land.
Now, you've done deep investigation into the countries of Sierra Leone and Mali in Africa. You've authored two Oakland Institute reports entitled Understanding Land Investment Deals in Africa. And I want to start with Mali, the nation of Mali. Where is it, Joan, and what can you tell us about its size and population?
Well, Mali is a remarkable country, perhaps it's not so well known in the West, that has a very long history of fantastic civilizations. I mean, most people may have heard of the city of Timbuktu and not know that it actually does exist. It's in Mali, it's on the Niger River, and back in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries, it was such a wealthy city that Europeans were desperate to get there. They thought they were going to find gold. In fact, it was a flourishing intellectual center with two universities, and there was a great deal of gold involved in the Mali Empire at that time, and several different ethnic groups had massive civilizations that covered most of West Africa from about 1200 AD right through to the 1800s, the period when the French colonists were moving in there. So it has an amazing history. It has fantastic music and culture and historical knowledge of itself, but it's a huge country and half of it is desert. And its lifeblood is the Niger River that flows through there. It sweeps all across West Africa from Guinea through Mali and then eventually down through Nigeria. People will have heard of the Niger Delta in Nigeria, which is so oil rich. That's the end of that river. And more than 100 million people depend on that river for their survival, for the water that it provides, because it is so dry. It runs right through the Sahelian countries that are really suffering from climate change and desertification. So in Mali, that river is the lifeblood. And back in the 1930s, the French, deciding that they wanted to compete against American cotton growers, decided to put a dam across the Niger River. It's about 300 kilometers or 170 or 80 miles from the capital, Bamako, downstream on the Niger. They built a dam to flood an inland oasis. And that area was supposed to be meant for growing cotton to compete with the United States. It never really happened, but it became a major, major rice growing area and the breadbasket of the country because they can irrigate, small-scale irrigation. And then the government set that up as called the Office du Niger, which is sort of a state entity, which was always intended to allow Malians to produce food. And unfortunately, that is where the land grabbing is happening. There have been, in the last 2 or 3 years, more than 600,000 hectares, according to the map that I was able to obtain in October 2010, more than 600,000 hectares of the country's most fertile and best watered land has been leased out long-term to foreign investors. That represents a significant percentage of the country's arable land because the rest of the country, people can only farm during the very short rainy season. And that means that they're really vulnerable when there are periods of drought. So that Office du Niger is the most important place in the country for producing food, and Mali has been doing very well in producing the rice and the foodstuffs that it needs. And with that land being leased out, not just for biofuels, which some of it is for biofuels for export, and of course they do not have the capacity to use biofuels in African countries. And the other is, for example, the lease from Libya for 100,000 hectares is meant for rice production and so on, and also no guarantee that any of it will stay in the country. So this is a significant risk to the food security, food sovereignty, and to the farming systems of the people in Mali.
To what extent is chronic hunger and poverty already a fact of life in Mali?
Well, Mali always comes in fairly close to the bottom of the UN list of least developed countries, partly because it does have such a difficult climate. And it has major livestock production, major farming production, but people really have enormous obstacles. The country is vast, and transport is very, very difficult for the smallholder farmers to get their produce to market. They have some incredible crops and tree crops, which are extremely important to them, which are now being taken by the outside world, like the karité or shea nut butter, which winds up in our shampoos. But of course, the producers are not being paid well for those things. So chronic hunger and periodic drought are almost perennial problems in Mali. Even if it's not the entire country, there will be pockets of extreme hunger and extreme drought from year to year. And so food aid is almost always needed in some parts of the country. So anything that takes land out of production for food for Malians needs to be considered a real risk to people's food security and as a threat to people's well-being.
Joan Baxter joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Joan is a research associate at the Oakland Institute, a policy think tank dedicated to advancing public participation and fair debate on critical social, economic, and environmental issues. And Joan has written two Oakland Institute reports entitled Understanding Land Investment Deals in Africa, one covering Sierra Leone and the other addressing the nation of Mali. Her two reports are part of the Oakland Institute's seven-country case study project to examine land acquisition in Ethiopia, Mali, Mozambique, Sierra Leone, Sudan, Tanzania, and Zambia. What do local communities in Mali know about how much of their farmland has been leased or is being considered for lease to big foreign investors?
Essentially, from my understanding of almost all the countries, I haven't just worked in those two countries, that's where I did the research, but certainly my understanding in all the places that I have been in Africa is that the population itself knows very little about this. They hear about agricultural investment, they're led to believe that this is something good for the country, that this is going to bring development, bring revenue for the government. But actually, they don't know anything about which lands are being taken, the leases that are being drawn up, what's in it for the country, what's in it for them, and what the risks are. As I said, in Mali at the moment, they're pretty well limited to the Office du Niger, which the government claims is state land, and they can do whatever they want with it. So that means that all of those indigenous populations that were living there before, and the smallholders that were working the small-scale irrigated plots, especially women who are producing massive amounts of market vegetables there, are the ones who are suddenly waking up and their trees are gone and their cropland is gone. And there have already been very ugly confrontations when the corporations came in to cut down these trees that take 40 years to grow and that provide the people with food security during the long, hungry season when it's dry, when it's not raining. And then what happens is that the state sends in security forces and arrests the local people who were protesting. In Mali, you have a rather remarkably well-developed civil society, and there are farmers associations, smallholder farmers, professional associations that have been raising the alarm cry and begging the government to make these deals public, to review the policies of giving out this land to foreign corporations and to foreign companies like, for example, foreign countries such as Libya. And to date, they have not been heard. The government of Mali, like most governments in Africa, is very much under the influence of the World Bank, which has been setting up in every single African country an investment promotion agency, which actually shapes the policies. And they will offer these huge agricultural investors, as they're called, 10, 20, 30-year tax holidays, enormous benefits of, you know, customs-free exemption, allowing to repatriate all of the profits. They're making such sweetheart deals for the investors and making sure that the investors are protected, and this is coming directly from the World Bank, that the question is, who's protecting the people? And also in Mali, they've set up, with the guidance and support from the World Bank, a Presidential Investment Council, which meets twice a year with the head of state to advise the head of state on investment policies. And who's on that Presidential Investment Council? 15 representatives of the biggest corporations working in Africa, such as Coca-Cola, Anglo Gold, Barclays, and so on. So the governments are being really pushed and influenced and convinced that this kind of agricultural investment is somehow good for them, without seeing that the government's getting very little revenue from it and that their own people are really suffering as a result of it.
Well, if the government's getting very little revenue from it, why would it go along with World Bank policy and give tax breaks and exemptions from custom duties and all that sort of thing?
The World Bank has a very interesting way of operating in Africa. And if you're a good pupil of the World Bank and the IMF, and often the IMF is against these kinds of tax incentives, so they're actually at loggerheads over this, but the World Bank funds and finances an awful lot of government programs. So governments don't have a lot of wiggle room when it comes to saying no to the World Bank. But in addition, many of them have been, and I hate to use the word, but it seems like it's the only word to use, brainwashed into believing somehow that by transforming their countries into these huge industrial kind of plantations and rendering their own people sort of tenants on their own land, that this is some kind of step forward, that this is progress, that this is development. And very few of them are questioning that model that's being presented to them very strongly and forcefully by the World Bank Group.
And is this also about getting loans, for example, from the International Monetary Fund, that they're has been a long-standing program of structural adjustment in Africa and other parts of the world, under which if a country adopts certain policies which tend to have a great deal of austerity as part of them, then the nation, the poor nation, qualifies for certain financial aid.
Absolutely. Structural adjustment programs, which in the end everybody finally admitted were terrible, and that they had actually accomplished the reverse of what they were supposed to do with the vicious cutbacks on social and health spending and on education and, you know, cutting out agricultural extension programs, for example, that help smallholder farmers. Those were discredited. So then the World Bank and the IMF and the so-called donor countries, that's the sort of G8 countries that say that they're the donors to Africa, came up with a new name for what is a very old game, and now it's called poverty reduction strategies. And they will claim that each country works to develop its poverty reduction strategy paper, which becomes the blueprint for the next 5 or 10 years. But in fact, when you look across Africa, you see that all of these poverty reduction strategy papers are almost identical. And it's the same old vicious privatization and making sure that investors and capital can come into the country and also flow out of the country. And yes, there are always conditions. If a government steps out of line very far, they will find themselves being criticized very, very strongly. And if a government can't pay its public servants and its military, then they're putting themselves in danger. So yes, they're in a vice.
That's the voice of Joan Baxter, research associate at the Oakland Institute and author of two reports, links to which we've placed on our website, againstthegrain.org. There you can find links to two reports she's authored about land acquisitions in Africa. One report covers Sierra Leone and the other covers Mali. You were referring earlier to something very important, so it's probably worth just pausing for a moment on this topic. In what ways have World Bank policies interfered with the sovereignty of governments like Mali's government over how the land of that nation or any other is developed, is used?
I think to a certain extent, you know, I'm going to find myself saying something that's rather bizarre, which is that when Dambisa Moyo wrote her book called Dead Aid, and the first half of it, she criticized the client states that are produced by aid-dependent countries. And there, an awful lot of what, of course, the World Bank does is not aid at all, it's loans, because it is, after all, a bank. So all of that is thrown into something called aid, which, as I say, much of it has to be paid back, but in any case, it's called aid. And the result of that is that they produce client states. Now, where I differ from Dambisa Moyo is that aid has produced client states, but I don't think the answer is more of the same, which is that foreign investors, whether they're after gold or uranium or coltan or diamonds, should be allowed even more free rein on the continent and even more cutbacks on education and health, which is exactly what happened. So she's suggesting that more of the same is going to help. But I say that those countries have to break free of being client states. Unfortunately, with the geopolitical arrangement of today, it used to be very much, since the end of the Cold War, it's very much been a free-for-all for the West in Africa when it came to resources. And I just add the land and the water to the resources that foreigners have always wanted from Africa, right back to the colonial days. And now, of course, you've got a very different situation in that you've got China and India and Brazil involved in Africa, also after resources. So what happens is that now more and more countries are coming in for the resources. The governments need some kind of revenue. They need somebody to help them with infrastructure. They have to meet the very high expectations of their people. So they will just go with whomever will offer them what looks like a short-term fix. And very often, what looks like a short-term fix is in the long run just a recipe for more hunger, more poverty, more chaos, and more conflict.
With all these foreign investors coming into the nation of Mali in Africa, what they're doing with the land is interesting and important. Talk about the methods of agricultural production used on or planned for the regions covered by these land leases and the degree to which those methods are environmentally friendly.
Traditionally, the smallholder farmers in Africa, if you can go back hundreds of years, had a very, very biodiverse farming system meant to diminish risks. They rely on fallows that involve trees, that provide them with medicine, that restore water supplies, that restore the soils. They have a broad diversity of crops that they grow, their own seeds that they've developed over centuries to deal with very different conditions, drought, and so on. They didn't need Monsanto to develop seeds for them that would be drought resistant or resistant to certain kinds of pests. Rather than build on that system, rather than recognize the benefits that there are in agroecological agriculture, and see how it can be actually strengthened. What's happening is that this kind of investment is going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The idea that there's any idle land in Africa or unused land in Africa or underused land in Africa suggests that the people making those comments don't understand the current land use. They don't understand the value of those trees that you find in the cropland and in fallows around the farms, because that's how the people make it through the year. They rely on so many different crops. So they're supporting, they're really protecting water resources, soil resources, and biodiversity and genetic diversity. All of the plantations in Mali and in Sierra Leone involve massive, you know, 10,000 hectares or more, industrial-style plantations with massive amounts of irrigation, massive amounts of pesticides and chemical fertilizers, and very, very little seed diversity that will be used.
Monocultures?
Monocultures. So following very much the, you know, the North American model, which only now are we realizing was unsustainable. And certainly in North America, those kinds of farms have been heavily, heavily subsidized to make them survive. And yet that's exactly the model that's being planned in Africa. And the environmental risks, especially at a time when climate change is hurting Mali so hard, the environmental risks are enormous. And in fact, the Libyan who heads the Malibia project in Mali, 100,000 hectares, says that the new irrigation canal that they're putting through there is going to use an amount of water every year from the Niger River, which nourishes an entire half a continent, that's equivalent to the water that all the 17 million people and all the industry use in Beijing, in the capital of China. So it's as if they're still not looking at the limited resources there are, and they just think that they can move into Africa and take over everything. And as I say, you're looking ahead at environmental catastrophes, especially at a time of climate change, and very heavy on fossil fuel use.
What about environmental impact assessments? I mean, we're talking about development, major development. Are assessments of some kind required by either the governments of Sierra Leone or Mali?
This is where we get into the real murky business. There is no kind of legal framework in either Mali or in Sierra Leone for this kind of agricultural investment. It's too new. They have mining codes that, you know, sets of laws that govern how mining is done. Not that that prevents pillaging and plundering and exploitation, but at least they have a legal framework. In Sierra Leone, they claim that every single operation has to have an environmental, social, health impact assessment. That only seems to hold if the investor is looking for money from European sources or European development banks or the World Bank, or is planning to export the biofuels to Europe where they have certain standards that they have to meet for sustainability. In Mali, I could not find a single environmental impact assessment. I was told they had been done by various government officials, but they told me that they were not public, they were not of concern to anybody but a few people within the government. So there was no way to get my hands on an actual environmental impact assessment there, although they claim they have been done. In Sierra Leone, the only environmental impact assessment that I saw while I was researching it was by the Swiss firm Addox Bioenergy, which is part of a very large Addox and Oryx group out of Switzerland that has been involved in African oil for quite some time. And they were absolutely forced to put together such an environmental health and social impact assessment because they were getting financing. In fact, they just got financing from the African Development Bank and from seven European development institutions, development banks. Now, the problem with even that environmental social health impact assessment is that it was done before the project started, and the company is now not adhering to the very pledges that were made in that study, which said they have to do this, they have to do this to protect the local people. They were supposed to have a small holder outgrower scheme where they would be purchasing cassava and sugarcane from local farmers to use in their ethanol factory. That hasn't happened. They've just switched now with the UN organization, FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, to have these farmer training schools. But one wonders what the point of that is when the farmers don't have the land anymore that they used to work close to their villages that's been taken over. So even if there is an environmental impact assessment, there's no guarantee that anybody's going to hold the corporation or the investor to the terms that are listed there. Sometimes it looks as if the environmental impact studies look a little bit like rubber stamps, like a hoop you have to jump through. You make it sound very good, but who's going to monitor how much water they use? Who's going to monitor how much pollution is in the river from the runoff from the plantations? They have very, very weak monitoring and control mechanisms in African countries. These are least developed countries we're talking about. So even if there is a study done, is it binding? Is it going to make any difference in the long run?
One issue that you bring up in these reports is the matter of who negotiates with the local landowners in order to obtain these leases, in order to finalize these deals. In Sierra Leone, apparently the foreign investors don't directly negotiate with landowners or local chiefs. Who represents the foreign investors, and what effect does that have on the legitimacy of what happens?
Well, again, it's a mixed bag. Because there's so little transparency in how this is done, it's very difficult to identify who is negotiating, where these deals are coming from. In the case of Addax Bioenergy, they started right at the very top with the president, who from day one endorsed the deal. And they work directly with the Minister of Agriculture. And they get a very prominent individual, or an MP, or somebody in certainly the ruling party, to go out with somebody from the company or an agent that's working with the company, or even the Sierra Leone Investment and Export Promotion Agency set up by the World Bank Group with funding from the European Union and from the Tony Blair Foundation. Those people will go out and identify land, or even there will be consultants brought in to go and identify land, and then they do often go and negotiate directly with a paramount chief. And this leaves the whole thing wide open for corruption, because a paramount chief has a lot of control over his people. And I say his because they're almost always men. And whether they're negotiating a lease for a diamond mine or they're negotiating a lease for farmland, the paramount chief may be satisfied with a very small gift. And then the rest of his people feel obliged and intimidated in his presence and will put their thumbprint on a lease that they have not even been able to read because they can't read and write. So they're really taking advantage of traditional social structures to get at this farmland, and they seem to have the complete backing of the government, the Minister of Agriculture, and the Sierra Leone Investment and Export Promotion Agency, which, as I say, is very heavily influenced by the World Bank Group.
I guess I was referring to something in your report about local coordinators or local agents, people from the community or very familiar with the community, going in and making certain representations about the deal to the landowners.
Yes, yes. In some cases, that's exactly what's happened. And sometimes the SLEPA, the Sierra Leone Investment and Export Promotion Agency, will even identify somebody for a foreign investor who can do that. And they're usually very well-connected, well-educated people from urban areas who have roots in that area, who can go and negotiate directly with a paramount chief or with a district chairman, the elected district chairman, and so on. So they work through the traditional system till they get to the paramount chief, get that man on board, and then the rest of the people are not very likely to say no. And certainly when the people have heard their own president, as they have in Sierra Leone, stand up and say, we have vast lands to give away, this will bring development, they're not going to question what he's saying. Very, very few people would dare to question what a paramount chief says, let alone what the Minister of Agriculture says or the President says.
Joan Baxter joins us today. She is author of two reports entitled Understanding Land Investment Deals in Africa, published and produced by the Oakland Institute, which is a policy think tank based in Oakland, California. You also indicate that there is a common misperception among Sierra Leoneans that most foreigners in their country, especially white foreigners, are doing what?
Development work, that they're there with, you know, charitable non-governmental organizations or with large NGOs such as, you know, the big ones, CARE, World Vision, and so on, because Sierra Leone is still trying to heal itself from an 11-year-long civil war that ended in 2002, which was fueled by diamonds. And as a result, there has been a massive effort by development people and charitable organizations to help the country rebuild. As a result, in rural areas, many of the people who spoke to us, who were talking about the investor who had just signed, they had just signed off their land to, referred to them as NGOs or a non-governmental organization. They did not know the difference between a large, wealthy corporation that's come to make profit and an NGO that's come to work with them to build schools and put in water wells and so on. And the other issue there is that the agents, whether it be an MP, the coordinators, those people who the investors use to convince local people. In one case, it was an MP for the ruling party. In another case, it was a very well-connected, prominent citizen who go in there and to convince the people that it's in their interest to give up their land, don't talk about the risks. They make them sound, the investors sound like development agents. They say they're going to build schools, they're going to build roads, they're going to put in wells, they're going to give you employment, they're going to make everything wonderful, you'll all be rich. So the people are convinced that this is in their interest, and they don't recognize that what's really happening is the reverse, that any corporation or investor that comes in there is going to take advantage of cheap labor. They're not going to give people full-time jobs if they can give them some casual hard labor. And what happens is that the people do not see and are not told about the risks. So because of the high expectations when the company comes in, and then the disappointment that's going to come afterwards when they realize their farmland is gone, there's the enormous risk of conflict in a country that already went through an absolutely brutal civil war.
You indicate that human rights violations have been committed against certain communities who've protested against these large-scale land leases. Tell us more about that.
In particular, the one that I'm thinking about was in Mali, where the women and the villagers went out when they saw their valuable trees coming down, trees that provide them with all of the oils that they cook with, being cut down. They went out and protested, and they were arrested en masse. I met a woman who lost a baby. She was pregnant. She was beaten by the security forces who were sent in to back up the investor. She lost a baby. An elderly woman showed me the scars on her knees where she had been beaten as well, as did an elderly man. These were just very simple smallholders in a rural area who one day woke up, and the next thing they knew, all of their farmland was being taken over and their trees were being cut down. And when they protested, they were either arrested or they were beaten, or both. And that was a massive human rights violation.
Could you expand on something you said earlier about the vulnerability, particularly of women, when it comes to these large-scale land deals?
Well, there are estimates that women farmers, because no woman in a rural area is not farming in Africa, that women produce between 50 and 70% of the food produced in Africa is produced by women. Women traditionally are not landowners. So even if they work a piece of land, it's within the family. They're given that land by a male head of the family who's considered the landowner of whatever is considered family land. As a result, they are not invited to the consultations. Even if they were present at consultations where this land deal is being discussed, they would not have a voice. They lose their land. They lose that food, and they're the ones who are feeding their children and paying the school fees for their children very often from their small fields and their farms. They're not entitled to even the meager land rent that is being paid. They're not entitled to anything, so they completely lose out. And very, very few of them, yes, may be employed by the company also as laborers, but that's a far inferior life to being able to provide for your family from your own farming.
I'm CS. She is Joan Baxter. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Joan is a journalist, an author, a researcher. She has, for the Oakland Institute, put together a report entitled Understanding Land Investment Deals in Africa. Actually, two reports, one covering Sierra Leone and the other covering the nation of Mali. Again, we have links to those reports and others at againstthegrain.org. Now, both the Malian and Sierra Leonean governments make public claims about the amount of land in their respective nations that, on the one hand, is being cultivated already, and on the other, is available to investors. What kind of information are they disseminating, and how would you evaluate what they're saying?
Well, once again, we have this issue of people from the outside, and certainly they're getting an awful lot of advice from the World Bank Group and so on. And they keep coming up with figures about unused or underused or marginal land that's available, as if there's nobody using that land. And as I say, the traditional farming system, they do not cultivate the same field every year. They will often leave it fallow for 10 years, 15 years, and while it's fallow, they're collecting very valuable medicinal plants, they're getting the products from the trees, they're using it for firewood, the soils are being replenished, they get wildlife from those areas that they leave fallow. So that is all used land. And yet the government makes it sound as if you're not cultivating one field every single year, that land is unused. And there are no recent surveys of land use in either Mali or Sierra Leone to show that what they're saying about available land is true. They just pull out these figures from nowhere. And when we investigated and we spent a long time trying to find some recent land use survey that would show how the land in the country was being used, and it doesn't exist. And yet they make it sound as if all this land is available, but it simply isn't.
Well, let's begin to wind down. I mean, one argument that might be made is that importation of food, okay, so maybe these foreign investors come in and they produce, say, agrofuels for export from the countries of Mali or Sierra Leone, and so then obviously that's less land for crops for the people in those respective nations. So somebody might say, well, look, in fact, maybe a lot of these African nations have a history of importing food. They can do that. They can continue to do that. Their governments might eventually make some money off of these land acquisition deals. What are the risks that go along with importing food into a country?
Well, I mean, that is the stereotype of Africa, is of a continent constantly in famine with everybody sitting there starving. And once again, that's a very unfair stereotype. African smallholders have enormous odds against them when they set out to farm and to try to make a decent living, to do more than subsist from what they produce. The road networks are horrendous. They can hardly get their foodstuffs to even local markets, let alone international markets. They have no processing equipment whatsoever, so they can't add any value to their cassava or to their palm oil or anything in the village. They have to compete with dumped, subsidized foodstuffs that come from the United States, from Europe, from India. In remote areas of Sierra Leone, the eggs available in the markets are from India. And on the box, it says they're farm fresh. There is no local poultry producer who can compete with that kind of dumped and subsidized produce coming from outside. So they've got a whole range of obstacles. They've had no support or investment since the structural adjustment program started, and all the subsidies were yanked off. Agricultural extension and training programs were eliminated. Very often there's no school in the villages, so the farmers can't read and write. They have no idea what the real value of the foodstuff that they're producing is. And as a result, you get this negative spiral where they start to import food. But on the other hand, very much of the food aid that has been contributed has actually hurt local farmers because it's undercutting the local farmers. So there have been enormous problems for them. And rather than address those problems, Now you're going to come in and take their land away from them, so they're going to even need more food aid and more imported food. And everybody knows that there is a need to produce enough food in this planet to feed the growing population. I don't think you're going to do it by taking large, large areas out of food production for local people and putting it into either biofuel production or into three or four food crops that are going to be exported to feed other parts of the world on a continent where there is hunger. Rather, you should be supporting those smallholders to produce more. Already, the urban areas in Africa are a mess. Now, half of the population of Accra in Ghana live in slums and shanty towns because they can't make a go of it in a rural area. If you take all the farmland and follow it through and picture what's going to happen to those people, those are large industrial plantations. They're heavily mechanized. They're not going to be labor intensive. Where are all those people going to go and what are they going to eat? Not to mention the effects socially. There's a social cohesion in rural Africa. People know each other. They trust each other. They're safe. The areas are free of crime. There's no drug abuse. None of those social ills exist in rural parts of Africa. What's going to happen when you turn those things, that farmland, into huge industrial plantations with migrant workers? You're going to have, as one politician said to me in Sierra Leone, it's a recipe for chaos.
And finally, many of the large agricultural projects documented in your reports are in their early stages. So is it possible that it is too early to pronounce judgment on the value and impact of these projects?
Well, that's very much what we were trying to do in the reports, because the World Bank and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and several donor countries and certainly the investors themselves like to portray this form of agricultural investment or agro-investment as a win-win situation. Win for the investor and also a win for the local people. So the whole purpose of the Oakland Institute reports, because this is a very recent phenomenon, it's a very huge phenomenon and there's been very little actual research into it, was the idea was to look in seven countries and try and find one investment where it really looked like it might be a win-win situation. And the result of that was that we didn't find any that met up to any of the expectations, and we see it being a win situation for the investor perhaps for a certain period of time, but a lose situation for the local population. And in the end, it's also a risk for the investor, because if they're making local people extremely unhappy and impoverished, then the very stability in the country and the protection that the investor may enjoy through World Bank insurance schemes is still not going to make their operations profitable, and it's also going to put at risk the political and social stability in those countries.
The Oakland Institute's seven-country case study project looks at land investment deals in seven nations in Africa, and Joan Baxter has written about two of them. The reports are Understanding Land Investment Deals in Africa. She's a research associate at the Oakland Institute, an independent journalist and author. She's lived and worked in Africa for three decades. Joan, thanks so much for bringing this information to light and for joining us today.
We're now going to hear the soundtrack of a short video on the financialization of nature, which has some quite appealing graphics, so it might work well if you're trying to explain this topic to a younger audience.
Stop the takeover of nature by financial markets. While people are concerned with the harsh austerity measures implemented in many European countries as a consequence of the financial crisis, financial actors are working almost unnoticed towards the submission of nature under their logic. We live in a so-called financialized economy, an economy dominated by finance and financial actors which focus on creating new investment and profit opportunities. The key to do it was the creation of a single global capital market through the abolition of control of movements of capitals by governments, the deregulation of large sectors of the economy, as well as the withdrawal of the state in providing essential services to citizens. Trading money, risk and associated products has become more profitable and outpaces trading goods and services for capital accumulation. This has huge implications over the daily exposure of people to financial markets in aspects which go from home ownership to pensions and schooling. In this financialization process, financial markets and its institutions take control over the productive economy where goods and services are produced, and corporations, households and banks are transformed to abide by the logic of financial markets by speculating or getting indebted. Instead of financial markets providing money to produce what people need, money is increasingly invested into financial markets to operate and expand. It literally turns the world upside down. Now, the housing bubble has burst, and the huge sums of money in financial markets are now seeking new investment opportunities, and this is where nature comes into the picture. About making profits with nature, we know already the role of financial players investing in mines, oil fields or agricultural activities, or purchasing cargoes of raw materials by playing on price trends or derivative markets. But the financialization of nature currently at work is a much deeper process. Back in 2005, the EU introduced the so-called Emission Trading Scheme, ETS, with the argument to reduce carbon emissions. In this scheme, companies are given a maximum of rights in the form of emission certificates to pollute the air with CO2. As the certificates can be traded between companies, financial markets were created and CO2 made a financial asset. This has created a profit opportunity for many companies and financial actors buying and selling emission certificates. EU economies continue to produce in an unsustainable and polluting way above the limits that the planet can support, rather than reducing their own emissions. The same proposals are being made for forests, biodiversity, or ecosystems, and all the ecological functions that could provide a service to humanity. To submit nature under the logic of financial markets requires to define what nature does as environmental service. So the tree's capacity to capture carbon, the decomposition of waste, water purification, and regulation of the climate is now defined, normalized, quantified, and certified as an environmental service. Once this is done, you can start placing a price tag to each service, evaluate their current status, state a limit, and concretize in economic terms the cost of their conservation in order to develop a market for each particular environmental service. So nature as such becomes a company, and for this, the green economy and market-based instruments are powerful tools for managing the economic invisibility of nature. With new property rights, a new phase of enclosures and extraction of natural resources and biodiversity, grabbing is taking place. So people are kicked off their lands, communities and nature are destroyed, and the global south becomes the loser. All those engaged in this green economy and financial markets become the winners. This green economy is no solution to any of the problems and crises we are facing today. Whether it is to deal with climate change, to maintain biodiversity and ecosystems, or to offer a solution to unemployment and unequal distribution of goods and wealth. There are many alternatives to solve these problems which are outside of the logic of financial markets. We must not privatize nature, submitting it to the profit interests of financial markets. We must defend and reclaim old and create new commons by excluding markets and financial markets from their management and control. This also includes the various public goods and services. We must change the way we produce and consume, orienting our economies towards real needs we have and towards more localized economies. We must promote a model of production and distribution of food based on food sovereignty, as well as decentralized and democratically controlled production of clean energies. We must shrink the financial sector, regulate it, and get it under democratic and public control to make sure it is functional to real needs and the public good. Get engaged in fighting against financial markets taking over the control of nature and in the promotion of real alternatives.